This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today, and as you can hear, I have the air conditioning on because summer is officially here, several weeks early. I looked at the forecast for this week, and basically the weather person said it's 10 degrees hotter than it normally is on average this time of year, both for the highs and the lows. So we've got ourselves a little heat wave, and I guess the heat wave is actually worse in other areas of the country. So we're getting off easy, which is fine. I don't have any disagreement with that at all. Anyways, it's been a good week. It's been a long week. Been trying to finish up with some projects that came up fairly unexpectedly at my major client, and I and the younger programmer, I should say, who was working on them together. His wife gave birth this week, and so he was otherwise occupied. And so I did get some things finished up there, and I had another project that's starting to heat up there as well. So it's been kind of scrambling along, trying to get some things in place so that next week I can get back to the original projects I was working on. But all seems to be going well. We certainly will have a little bit of fixing up to do here and there, but all in all goes well. In other news, I went ahead and released all the little videos that I had done of the Windows 7 application, and those seem to be received. I'm at this point still trying to decide whether or not it's worth the time and effort to convert the existing application over to iPhone. I had one of those things that programmers go through. There is the normal way that you develop iPhone applications is with something called Xcode and Interface Builder from Apple. You get those tools free. Well, there's another tool called MonoTouch that actually uses C#, which I'm more used to, and so I was trying that out. Unbeknownst to me, in the middle of all this, Apple had released an upgrade for Xcode. They went from Xcode 3 to Xcode 4, which was a fairly substantial upgrade, and pretty much broke some things with MonoTouch. So I was trying to go through and follow the tutorials and for MonoTouch, and nothing was lining up. I was like, what? Where's the library window? How do I make outlets? Blah, blah, blah. You know, and I'm going back. Finally, I got digging around on Google, and sure enough, they said down in their documentation, you don't want to use Xcode 4. So, got to do a little reverting and shuffling some things around. Sometimes people don't really appreciate everything that goes into actually building a program. I really appreciate how long some of these things take, but hey, you know, it's all part of the biz. So that's fine. This may be a little shorter podcast today than normal. I actually had a stop I needed to make, and so I'm kind of driving around the neighborhoods, but I don't know that I will estimate this timing as well. So we may end up with a 15-minute ramble as opposed to a 20-minute ramble. If you're wondering why when we quit after 20 minutes. Anyways, so last week we had started chatting about The Grand Design by Stephen Hawking. And I expected that to only take one episode, but the more I rambled about it, I suddenly realized that I was getting onto my driveway at home. And so I postponed a few other little small observations I wanted to make about that book for today. I had started talking last week about the progression of science and how that I firmly believe that creation is here for us to discover the secrets that God has placed into creation. The reason my head is whipping back and forth is because I'm waiting to make a left turn as I'm coming out of a subdivision. There we go. That God has created our environment in such a way that he hides secrets and he makes them available for us to discover. And I think part of his joy with humanity is when they do discover his secrets. The proverb says it is the glory of God to hide a thing and the glory of kings to seek it out. And because of that, I firmly believe that we are on a progression in science, as I mentioned last week, that man begins because he does not understand the complexity of the world and he's willing to acknowledge a God. And then as soon as the world becomes more and more complex, his idea of God grows and grows to the point that he becomes intimidated by God, and therefore he doesn't want to acknowledge a God anymore. But there comes a point where his knowledge, I think, will increase until mankind has a very profound decision to make, that it will become harder and harder not to acknowledge that there isn't some sort of organizing principle. And I had noted last week that one of the, what I consider to be an encouraging sign, is that physicists have now abandoned the idea of realism, that there is an objectivity to our existence and that it is actually real, because the quantum world and their studies of the quantum world and discoveries in the quantum world and experimentations have led them to believe there's more to existence than just what we experience, that there is a whole other level of experience that does not correspond to the rules that we commonly experience of being in one place at one time and having limitations on how fast knowledge can be transferred between entities. So last week we talked about this new embrace of subjectivity, and then this week I thought I'd just really quickly go over a few of the things in the book that made me kind of tilt my head to the side and go, well, okay. Because a lot of the new theories that are being floated out there are being floated specifically because there are behaviors which physicists do not understand, behaviors in the quantum realm. And so they come up with these working theories. Some of them are supported by observation. Some of them are just theories. So, for instance, the double slit experiment, which seems to indicate that light is both a particle and a wave. And I've talked about the double slit experiment before, and there's plenty of information. One of the interesting things about the double slit experiment that was talked about in the book was the fact that if you take a light and shine it on the particles before they go through the slits, that you end up with a particle pattern on the back wall, i.e. once you observe these particles, they collapse to a singular existence and they behave as if they have a singular existence. But if you shut off the light, they behave as if they have a multiple existence and they make waves as opposed to particles. What is also intriguing is that if you shine the light just before they hit the screen, after they've already transitioned through the slits, they once again collapse and behave as particles. But supposedly the thing that's creating the interference pattern is the slits, and they've already transitioned through the slits, so how did they know at the point they were transitioning through the slits that they were going to collapse and become a particle? There's all these really interesting explanations. One of the explanations, one of the theories, was that, well, the reason they know that is because they don't move through time like we think of them moving through time, that they travel in all the possible permutations, whether it's around the world and then through the slit and hitting it, whatever it is, all the possible permutations. And only the probabilities of their waveform determines the likelihood that they're going to hit in a certain spot, and that by introducing light wherever you introduce it in the time flow, it changes the probabilities to the point that even though the particles have already gone past the slits, it changes the probability sufficiently that it becomes a particle. Well, that's one explanation. And a lot of quantum mechanics has grown out of that explanation. There is another explanation, and that was by the guy who did the many worlds theories. And his explanation was, and it was kind of scoffed and poo-pooed for a while, but then there's more people saying, well, maybe that's an explanation for this, because it's quite the conundrum. His explanation is that at any given point, when there are more than one possibilities for what this particle might do, in fact, the universe branches. So for every decision point possible, all the way down at the particle level, the universe is constantly branching and creating new universes. I mean, these are all really interesting things. What I find intriguing about this is that they went on to talk then about the fact that, well, if things are branching all the time, or if this particle is taking all the different potential paths that it could take, then to calculate what the probabilities are of the waveform, you end up dealing with infinities. And as you calculate through your infinities, you end up with a particle that has infinite mass and infinite charge. And then they said, well, of course, we know that can't be right, because we can measure the mass and charge of an electron, and it's not infinite. So then they do this thing called renormalization, where they just sort of cancel out the infinities. And I got really tickled at one point in the book where they were talking about renormalization, because they actually said something like, well, these manipulations might sound like the sort of things that you get you a flunking grade on a school math exam. And renormalization is indeed, as it sounds, systematically dubious, but it's useful. Okay. Okay, so this reminds me of the little cartoon with the two scientists, and one has drawn all his calculations on the board, and he starts with this amazing number of calculations, and he ends with this amazing number of calculations, and in the center he has drawn a couple of square brackets and written in the center, and the other scientist points to the center part and he says, I think you need be more specific in this part, and that center part says, then a miracle occurs. So some of this stuff, as you read through it, you keep thinking, yeah, and then a miracle occurs. Because aside from all how did this actually get started, which they're still working on, there's this other big then a miracle occurs thing of how does it continue? If, in fact, our reality is based on top of this quantum realm where time moves forward and backwards and things have superposition where they can be in multiple positions at the same time and information is translated instantly between entangled particles, how does all of that resolve on a seeming constant basis and become the world that we know, where things don't just evaporate, where tables aren't in three positions at the same time, and where time flies like an arrow? It goes one direction, and fruit flies like a banana. So it's the old saying, sorry. Anyways, so how does it get there? And that's, again, in brackets, then a miracle occurs. And so as near as I can tell, this M theory that they talk about in the book, where that is a whole series of overlapping theories to try to explain and the predictions that, in fact, we do live in this huge multiverse where there's all an infinite number of universes out there, and anything that could happen can happen. You know, as near as I can tell, all of this evolves, is birthed out of, comes from, whatever phrase you want to use, over the fact that there are some things that just don't make sense in quantum mechanics. And so to get around that, and to get around this wonderful balance and symmetry that we find in this world as we analyze things like the cosmological constant, that if it was just off by a little bit, matter wouldn't exist. I think it's matter that won't exist. All those conundrums, to get around all that, then in the book, what they propose is this infinite number of universes that are out there, and we just happen to be in a good one. In fact, they propose what they call the strong anthropic principle, which is not original with them, but they back it. And the strong anthropic principle says that because we're here, and because we have the capability to observe, and because we have the knowledge and the ability to figure out how things work, we obviously are going to find a universe that is completely suited to us and completely balanced and completely symmetrical and completely super... And completely symmetrical and has everything in perfect harmony. Obviously we're going to, because if it didn't, we couldn't exist. So, therefore... we are the lords of creation. Okay. It's the Goldilocks effect. You know, times 15 kajillion. It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. Because if it wasn't, we wouldn't be here. Well, you know, I can imagine, I'm getting my mail. I can imagine that things don't need to be nearly as perfect as they are. And yet, for some reason, we are, you know, in the middle of this wondrous, gorgeous world. And it's astronomically improbable that we would, since there's an infinite number of universes, it's astronomically improbable to me that we would just happen to luck out and get to be the ones who exist in the world that's really cool. That we would just happen to luck out and be on the planet that is perfectly positioned to make astronomical observations. That we just happen to be on a planet that just happens to have a moon that is 1/400th the diameter of the sun and is 1/400th the distance between us and the sun. So we get these gorgeous total eclipses that help us learn about, you know, there's all these things that we just happen to be in the right place at the right time over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I realized that supposedly there's an infinite number of universes. I'm backing into my garage, and I have noticed that I don't talk loud enough when I back into my garage, so I am talking louder until I get into my garage. It is... possible that we just happen to be, you know, the one race that gets the benefit of all of this stuff and just happened among the infinite universes to be that one. But it seems like there could be other combinations where things would not be as beautiful and balanced as they are. And I decided I would go out, now that I can look at my notes, and I would just kind of get what the reactions have been from other people. Well, evolutionary biologist and advocate for atheism, Richard Dawkins, welcomes this book. He says, Darwinism kicked God out of biology, but physics remained more uncertain. Hawking has now administered the coup d'etat, coup de grace. Okay, well, you would expect him to be pretty happy with the book, since... the direction that Hawking and his friends are leading is not only that we don't need a God, but that potentially we'll never be able to figure anything out. More on that in a moment. Because everything is so chaotic and everything is so unknowable that we might just have to resign ourselves to saying, well, no way this is ever going to get figured out. More on that in a moment. Anyways, there's a whole bunch of people. Roger Penrose doubts that adequate understandings can come from this approach and points out that, quote, unlike quantum mechanics, M-theory enjoys no observational support whatsoever. That's interesting because supposedly one of the things that makes it a good model in the book is that it has observational support. Joe Silk in Science suggests that, quote, some humbleness would be welcome here. A century or two hence, I expect M-theory will seem as naive to cosmologists of the future as we now find Pythagoras' cosmology of the harmony of the spheres. And I mean, it goes on and on, on and on and on. Dwight Gardner from the New York Times. The real news about the grand design is how disappointingly tinny and inelegant it is. The spare and earnest voice that Mr. Hawking employed with such appeal in A Brief History of Time has been replaced here by one that is alternatingly condescending, as if he were Mr. Rogers explaining rain clouds to toddlers, and impenetrable. And I have to agree. And so, anyways, and I mean, it goes on and on. I've found quote after quote after quote where people were not that thrilled with it. Last one from Joe Horgan of Scientific America. M-theory theorists now realize comes in an almost infinite number of versions, which predict an almost infinite number of possible universes. Critics call this the Alice's Restaurant problem, in reference to the refrain from the old Arlo Guthrie folk song, "You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant." Of course, a theory that predicts everything doesn't really predict anything. The anthropic principle has always struck me, I'm sorry, this is what he said. Okay, this is unkind. The anthropic principle has always struck me as so dumb that I can't understand why anyone takes it seriously. It's cosmology's version of creationism. The physicist Tony Rothman, with whom I worked at Scientific American in the 1990s, liked to say that the anthropic principle in any form is completely ridiculous and hence should be called crap. Hawking is telling us that unconfirmable M theory plus the anthropic tautology represents the end of that quest. If we believe him, the joke's on us. Okay, well, yeah. So, needless to say, not everybody is thrilled about this book. What was interesting is when I was watching a YouTube video on the many worlds theory and that sort of thing, they had a Dr. Michio Keiku, who's the first one who I believe proposed string theory. He was really interesting to listen to because he was talking about, first of all, the process of how they're trying to figure all this stuff out. And I think it shed some light on the thrashing that physicists are going through at this point, trying to come up with an explanation for our existence, how we got here, quantum theory, all that sort of thing. He said, and he was talking about using a particle collider to try to tear apart matter to figure out what it's made of. And he used the analogy of, he said, this is like someone trying to figure out what a piano is by throwing it down a flight of stairs and then listening to the tinkling sounds it makes when it breaks apart. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. That would be a hard task. He also said something else that was very interesting, and that is that the standard theory, quantum mechanics standard theory, which has proven to be very successful in observational sport. We're not talking about M theory. We're talking about quantum mechanics standard theory. He said it is the ugliest theory known to science, in his opinion. The analogy that he used was that it was like taking a lot of scotch tape and an aardvark and a shark and a giraffe and taping them all together and then saying, that's nature's finest product in evolution. He said, on the other hand, gravity, the equations for gravity are beautiful. According to him, he said, scientists look at those equations and they just cry because they are so beautiful. And so it's interesting. What we have now is this struggle between what looks elegant and beautiful and then trying to explain away how that could possibly happen and these other puzzles that don't seem to fit with that. And scientists are thrashing back and forth. And I don't know if we're on the threshold yet of that third wave of science where we finally say, you know, this doesn't make any sense at all. There must be some organizing principle here that keeps everything together. But honestly, while some scientists get there, I do not believe that all scientists will get there. Because as I mentioned when I said, you know, we'll get back to that in a moment. When we talk about the hubris that's being expressed, when we talk about theories that are being floated that don't have any observational support, all those sorts of things, this reminds me of something else. And it reminds me of evolutionary theory, biology, because while there is some really intriguing things about evolution in terms of tracing the changes in animals physically, there's are these big gaps in the record. There is this big conundrum of how did this all get started? How did we go from a rock to DNA? You know, that's those brackets again. Then a miracle occurred. And there is another, what I consider to be, fairly interesting theory in terms of all of these changes that we see in the biological record, and that is maybe things were designed to change to environmental stressors. Because now we're finding out that, in fact, it's not just genes. There are switches in with the genes that turn genes on and off due to environmental stressors. And so this idea of environment affecting physicality, which was poo-pooed, maybe is not so far off. So how did we get from this really interesting DNA design where we have the HOX genes that we've talked about before that stipulate body type, and they stipulate left and right and front and back and top and bottom, and those HOX genes seem to have somehow survived nearly unchanged for 600 million years, if the timelines are correct. How did we have that, and yet we have these other things that are changing? It's like DNA knows what to change and what not to change, because it's in the brackets, then a miracle occurs. And I think ultimately when you pull a designer out of these equations, when you pull a designer out of DNA and out of evolution, when you pull a designer out of this amazing balance that we enjoy in creation, that you end up at the same point, and that it is some form of intellectual suicide. I've quoted my little saying before, and I'll just give you the abbreviated version of it, that if you're an evolutionist, you have to believe that everything came about by chance. And if you believe everything came about by chance, you believe your brain came about by chance, and yet you're relying on this flawed, undesigned, mutated, most of which mutations were not beneficial, device to actually figure out how life began on the planet and what happened with life. And to me, that's intellectual suicide. Because if there is no designer, how do I know that anything I or any other human being are coming up with is actually correct, is actually meaningful? Maybe we're all just deluded and we're not really observing the world as it is. And I think the same sort of path ends up in physics. And we're seeing that now, that the physics theories becomes more and more and more convoluted because there is this desire to take out a designer. But once you take him out, I think things are designed in such a way that you'll eventually have to throw up your hands and say, we're never going to figure this out because everything is completely random. And the fact that we're in this universe has nothing to do with real reality. We just lucked out, and so we'll never know how everything came apart, because any theory that we kind of come up with is going to have problems, because there's an infinite number of universes out there, and we are minuscule and nothing and nothing and nothing and nothing, and eventually you just have to throw up your hands and say that's it. So it's a really interesting time in science, and it's really fun to watch all of these progressions. And it's going to be really interesting to see what comes out of CERN with the new super collider. But I'll keep watching, and you keep watching, and then maybe we'll chat about it again some more. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it
home.